Thanks a lot, Mary. Very kind of you. Ladies and gentlemen, when I was asked to give this short presentation, I was really not sure what to talk about to an audience which is of completely unknown construction, but then I realized that you are not going to be neuroscientists. At least most of you are likely to be either policymakers or media experts. So I decided to make a mix. In the first half of the talk, I will present the way how we arrived to the establishment of the Hungarian Brain Research Program, which was not an easy task, knowing the economical situation of this country. And in the second half, having emphasized the importance of discovery research, I will list you just one example, a very brief example, how pure curiosity-driven research, real basic research, can give rise to major discoveries in the field of understanding the mechanisms of various brain disorders and eventually even new drug targets or drugs. So the title speaks for itself. And as Mary already said, the greatest intellectual challenge of science and of mankind of today is understanding the brain. Why do we say that? It's because the brain is supposed to be the most complex form of matter we know today. And it is a philosophical question whether the brain can ever understand itself. So we are in a situation when the tool of understanding and the target of understanding is basically the same. But this is insufficient reason for policymakers to devote large funds for understanding the brain. They speak more the language of money. And as Mary already mentioned, disorders of the brain represent the greatest societal and economical challenge of mankind. She already mentioned these numbers, so let me just quickly go through these. According to this study initiated by the European Brain Council, of which Mary has been vice president for several years when I was also a member, and then later she became president of the EBC. So that study, which I think was very important from the point of view that policymakers all over Europe realized finally that there is really an amazing cost associated with brain disorders. And how much this really is, you can understand when you compare it to the five next most expensive disorders, which are listed here. Brain disorders on their own is nearly 800 billion, whereas these five combined together is only 500 million. It is easy to understand why, if you consider that a cancer patient or a cardiac arrest patient will die relatively quickly, but if a child is born with schizophrenia or autism in a family, is going to live a complete life, and throughout his or her life, she's going to depend on continuous medication, and perhaps even one family member will be taken out from work. This all adds up to the cost of these disorders. Alzheimer's disease can happen at 60 to 70 years of age, and then this patient can live another 20, 30 years, again, completely being dependent on family, society, medical care. So, indeed, there is a huge health economical pressure, but also, as Mary mentioned, a societal pressure, which can completely ruin the lives of certain families who have to live together with such patients, and there are many. Over 30% of the families have to cope with one such brain disorder person. And the prospects are not terribly bright. This burden keeps growing. This is largely due to the aging population, which means that the incidence of these dementias are going to increase in proportion. And then I also keep emphasizing the effect of the information explosion and the communication technologies. They result in a flood of information that puts the human brain under a kind of adaptational pressure. Human brain has not been designed originally to digest that much information, and that means a kind of adaptational pressure. And this can result in This can result in the spread of addiction, depression, anxiety, chronic stress, and even schizophrenia. According to the data of WHO, the most devastating diseases from the economical point of view in the 2030s are going to be depression, anxiety, and their somatic consequences. So all these combined together, I think they represent sufficient reason to suggest that a high priority should be given to brain research into understanding the mechanisms of brain disorders. And this has to be an urgent political task. New drugs, new pharmacotherapies, or prevention strategies can only be expected from new discoveries. New discoveries means basic research, discovery research, or curiosity-driven research, as you like. This has been realized in Europe when the Human Brain Project has been established, and this has been realized in the US when the Brain Initiative began. But even before that, the Hungarian government already in 2012, December, they announced the Hungarian Brain Research Program, and they devoted 40 million euros for 4 years, which is the largest ever support given in Hungary to any branch of science. And this was followed just a month later by the European Union Human Brain Project, which Sean is going to talk about in detail. And then another 2 months later, President Obama announced the US Brain Initiative. How is the Hungarian Brain Research Program structured? We built it on 5 pillars: discovery research, clinical neuroscience, which consists of neurology, psychiatry, and neurosurgery, and then pharmaceutical research. This is quasi-basic research, but directly related to the development of new drug targets, bionics, infobionics, and then epidemiology, neuroethics, law, societal, economical implications. The consortium that has been assembled to establish this, or to carry out this program, consists of 5 universities, medical universities mostly, and the Peter Pasmann Catholic University Faculty of Information Technology, and then 3 academy institutes and the drug company. It would take another hour to list the already obtained and I think very important results, so I'm not going to do that, just mention what I consider as one of the major gains that we can already show by this program during the last couple of years, is the establishment of over 30 new laboratories, brain research laboratories in various universities, various departments. And out of these 30, 8 or 9 have been established by neuroscientists, Hungarian scientists, who have been brought back from the US or Western Europe. And I think that is a major gain. And these new laboratories were established in those university departments and institutes which had long traditions in neuroscience, but by today, the research in these places have really subsided due to the overload of teaching. So research had to be re-implanted into these traditionally famous departments, and then I believe this has been a very good tool to achieve that. And we believe that if we only consider the results of these 30 new labs, we will already be able to account for the expenditure of all this money. And of course, we expect new spin-off companies to be established on the results of basic research discoveries, which will mean new jobs as well. So, discovery research. Let me then switch to this one single example, which I want to just very briefly describe to you. We have always been working on the cerebral cortex, which is the seat for our higher nervous activity, learning and memory, conscious perception, the design of our movements and actions, and all these higher nervous functions are linked to the activity of nerve cell complex networks that reside in the cerebral cortex. Cerebral cortex has nearly 100 billion neurons, and each of these 100 billion neurons can connect to 50 to 100,000 others. So they form an extremely complicated, complex network, and these networks are able to be responsible for all these tasks which I just mentioned. With all these connections which they established with each other, which are called synapses, if you count all this, we end up with 10 to the 14 synapses. The synapses are the sites where the impulses can propagate from one nerve cell to another nerve cell. Each nerve cell has two kinds of processes. One which behaves like an antenna, it is collecting impulses from many other neurons, like from 20 to 30,000 others. And the other processes are the so-called axons, which are forwarding the impulses and pass it on to the next neurons in the chain. And when the axon or a terminal process of one neuron meets the antenna process of the other neuron in the chain, then impulses can propagate from the pre to the postsynaptic cell. So this is called the synapse. And these synapses on the cortex are excitatory, which means that if you activate this neuron, it is going to activate or bring this cell closer to firing threshold. So enhance the chance of this neuron getting activated. So that's why these connections are so-called excitatory connections. And they use a neurotransmitter, which is called glutamate. When the impulse comes, then these small green vesicles, which in reality are, I guess, not green, these green vesicles empty their content, their glutamate content, into this cleft. And then this glutamate diffuses across this cleft and binds to receptors on the receiving side of the synapse. And then these receptors open ion channels, and then this chemical step is going to be converted again to an electrical impulse which propagates to the neuron. So these synapses are responsible for spreading excitation along the processes of complex networks of nerve cells. So it is of major importance to control the efficacy of these synapses. These synapses can be changing in their efficacy according to experience, and this is the most elementary unit of memory, because memories are imprinted into our brain circuits, into our cortical circuits, by potentiating these synapses. But what happens if you just endlessly potentiate synapses in these complex excitatory networks? You will arrive to hyperactivity and hypersynchrony in the neuronal network activity, which is nothing else than epilepsy. So unless you always wanted to end up with epileptic activity in your brain, you have to build some breaks into the network which are able to control the efficacy of the impulse transfer from one neuron to the next neuron. And the strengths of these synapses are often regulated in a feedback manner. So the receiving cell can signal back to the forwarding cell that, thanks, I had enough of you, I don't want more excitation, because then we will explode into an epileptic discharge. So, but this retrograde signal molecule was unknown. And that's when the story begins. Cannabinoids, like the psychoactive effect of marijuana, delta-9 THC, and the endogenous compounds that bind to the same receptor, which are called endocannabinoids, namely one of them is 2-arachidonoyl-glycerol, they were shown to reduce glutamate release. And this means already that there is a mechanism that can reduce glutamate release from active neurons and thereby could control the efficacy of the synaptic transmission. But we did not know where do these cannabinoids or endocannabinoids act, which means where are the receptors. If you have a substance that acts on neurons, it means that neuron has to express a kind of receptor, a protein, that would selectively bind this ligand and convey its effect to the neuron. So we don't know where are the chemically sensitive sites for cannabinoids or endocannabinoids, where are the receptors, and where are these endocannabinoids synthesized. So that's when we came into the picture, and we managed to localize at the light and electron microscopic level the receptor for cannabinoids, both THC and the endogenous representative of cannabinoids 2AG. This is the CB1 receptor. And the synthetizing enzyme of 2AG, the endocannabinoids, is this enzyme, diacylglycerol lipase, or DGL. So if we localize these two enzymes or receptors, then we already know where the endocannabinoids are synthesized on one hand, and where are they going to act. So in this immunolocalization, you can see lots of little brown dots. These are the immunocytochemically detected sites of CB1 receptor on this panel and DGL on this panel. What are these tiny little dots? This you can only answer by electron microscopy. So if you do electron microscopy, in this case on DGL, you can see that DGL is contained in spines, in the antenna kind of processes, those processes that receive the synapses. And you can see that each of these stained profile is facing another unstained profile that is full with synaptic vesicles. These small vesicles are those which you perhaps remember on the previous picture were green on this schematic drawing. These contain glutamate, the excitatory transmitter, and this glutamate is going to empty into this space and act on this dendritic spine. And the dendritic spine, the receiving part of the synapse, is expressing the enzyme which is synthesizing the endocannabinoids. So where are then the receptors? The receptors are on the other partner of the synapse, on the axon terminals, which are full of synaptic vesicles, which are releasing glutamate. With immunogold labeling, you can also see that in the axon terminal membrane, you have these black dots. These represent the immunoreactivity. This is CB1 receptor, cannabinoid receptor. This is the synthesizing enzyme of the endocannabinoid, and it is sitting on the membrane of the receiving compartment of the synapse. So, we then have an amazing scenario that the synthesizing enzyme of endocannabinoids is on the receiving end, and the target of the endocannabinoid on the axon terminal, that is forwarding the action. When we looked at it in detail, we also found that the endocannabinoid synthesizing enzyme was always very close to the synaptic active zone, in the postsynaptic spine, very, very close to the synaptic active zone. If you quantify that, you have a very skewed distribution. 25% of the immunogold particles were localized in a 60 nanometer wide perisynaptic annulus. So the synaptic active zone was surrounded by this enzyme. And why is it so interesting? This very high resolution subcellular localization is because it perfectly aligns with the distribution of one of the receptors for glutamate, this excitatory neurotransmitter. And why is that important? It's because this type 5 receptor of glutamate is able to synthesize or activate an enzyme cascade that will finally synthesize one of the endocannabinoids 2AG. What does it mean? It means that in the perisynaptic zone, you have a co-alignment of a receptor for glutamate and the synthesizing enzyme machinery for an endocannabinoid. And why that is interesting, I will show you on this schematic diagram. The excitatory impulse, electric impulse, comes in the presynaptic terminal. It opens voltage-gated calcium channels, which results in the release of glutamate, the excitatory transmitter. This excitatory transmitter then binds to the postsynaptic receptors, which are here, and then it allows the regeneration of the electrical activity. Now, what happens if there is too much activity on the presynaptic side? Hyperactivity, what you would expect in epilepsy. The frequency of the presynaptic discharge is much, much faster. A lot more calcium enters, and a lot more glutamate will be released into the synaptic cleft. If a lot of glutamate is released, then it will spill over from the active zone, and it is going to reach the perisynaptic annulus, where we have all the machinery for the retrograde signaling. And this is this machinery, this receptor of glutamate, which I mentioned, and through an enzyme cascade, it activates the enzyme that will synthesize the endocannabinoid. This endocannabinoid will travel to the presynaptic terminal, and binding to the CB1 receptor, it is able to close the calcium channel. So even if further electrical impulses will be passing down to this axon terminal, there will be no glutamate, no transmitter released from this terminal. So it operates perfectly like a circuit breaker or a fuse. If too much current wants to flow, then there is a machinery which will stop, which will put a brake in. And that is absolutely critical, that in normal neuronal activity, you will not end up with epileptic hyperactivity. Because as soon as hyperactivity would start, this circuit breaker will come into action and will block synaptic propagation. So, encouraged by this finding, which we published in Nature Medicine a couple of years ago, we named this assembly of macromolecules the perisynaptic signaling machinery, or PSM, which we consider as a circuit breaker, which has a fundamental function in controlling hyperactivity in neuronal networks. And when you look at each member of this machinery, you realize that mutating any of these enzymes will, experimental animals, will result in epilepsy. So it was not difficult to predict that if cannabinoid receptors are missing from these assemblies, from the presynaptic terminal, you will end up in epilepsy. So we obtained surgical samples from epileptic patients. When epilepsy cannot be controlled any longer by anti-epileptic drugs and the focus can be circumscribed quite well, then surgery helps. In 80% of the surgery cases, the patient will be seizure-free. And we receive the focus tissue, which we know gives rise to the epileptic discharges. And on this focus tissue, we can do all kinds of experiments. We showed that cannabinoid receptors expression level was down in both the sclerotic and non-sclerotic cases of epilepsy compared to the normal controls. This is human lobectomy tissue. This you can also see in the immunocytochemical picture. This is the control, and look at how much the density of the cannabinoid receptor goes down in these patients. So, you can easily conclude then, if hyperactivity comes and glutamate will spill over the synaptic active zone and activates this perisynaptic signaling machinery, 2AG, the endocannabinoid, will get synthesized, will travel to the presynaptic terminal to block further transmitter release, but it is not going to find a receptor there. So the circuit breaker is not going to work. So we believe that in several forms of epilepsy, we were able to point to a new potential drug targets to treat epilepsy. And do I have another minute?
Very quick.
Yeah, half a minute, okay. So we showed that the same machinery also works on inhibitory synapses, and we have shown that cannabinoid receptors are selectively expressed by one of the inhibitory cell types, and this inhibitory cell type expresses all the known drug targets for treating anxiety. So we consider this cell as a kind of common denominator of anxiety, anti-anxiety drugs, and we have been searching for potential drugs, and we arrived to one of these compounds that derive from echinacea. And this echinacea compound, we showed, were acting on the endocannabinoid signaling system, and it produced a similar degree of anxiolytic effects without any side effects compared to the well-known benzodiazepines. And this now gave rise to a compound, to a medicine, that is now marketed in the United States. So all these studies were just curiosity-driven research. We only wanted to understand how activity is controlled in hyperactive networks. We arrived to a major discovery of the retrograde signaling system, that endocannabinoids are responsible for this operation as a circuit breaker, and then that gave rise to one potential drug target in epilepsy and also in the control of anxiety. So that was my message for today. Thank you.